Simon & Schuster Audio presents Under the Dome, a novel by Stephen King. Read by Raul Esparza.
Who are you looking for? What was his name? You can probably find him at the football game. It's a small town. You know what I mean. It's a small town, son. And we all support the team. James McMurtry. The Airplane and the Woodchuck. 1. From 2,000 feet, where Claudette Sanders was taking a flying lesson, the town of Chester's Mill gleamed in the morning light like something freshly made and just set down. Cars trundled along Main Street, flashing up winks of sun. The steeple of the Congo Church looked sharp enough to pierce the unblemished sky. The sun raced along the surface of Presteel Stream as the Seneca 5 overflew it, both plane and water cutting the town on the same diagonal course.
Chuck, I think I see two boys beside the Peace Bridge, fishing.
Her very delight made her laugh. The flying lessons were courtesy of her husband, who was the town's first selectman. Although of the opinion that if God had wanted man to fly, he would have given him wings, Andy was an extremely coaxable man, and eventually Claudette had gotten her way. She had enjoyed the experience from the first, but this wasn't mere enjoyment, it was exhilaration. Today was the first time she had really understood what made flying great, what made it cool. Chuck Thompson, her instructor, touched the control yoke gently, then pointed at the instrument panel.
I'm sure, he said, but let's keep the shiny side up, Claudie, okay?
Sorry.
Not at all.
He had been teaching people to do this for years, and he liked students like Claudie, the ones who were eager to learn something new. She might cost Andy Sanders some real money before long. She loved the Seneca, and had expressed a desire to have one just like it, only new. That would run somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million. Although not exactly spoiled, Claudie Sanders had undeniably expensive tastes, which, lucky man, Andy seemed to have no trouble satisfying. Chuck also liked days like this. Unlimited visibility, no wind, perfect teaching conditions. Nevertheless, the Seneca rocked slightly as she overcorrected.
You're losing your happy thoughts. Don't do that. Come to 120. Let's go out Route 119 and drop on down to 900.
She did. The Seneca's trim once more perfect. Chuck relaxed. They passed above Jim Rennie's used cars, and then the town was behind them. There were fields on either side of 119 and trees burning with color. The Seneca's cruciform shadow fled up the blacktop, one dark wing briefly brushing over an ant-man with a pack on his back. The ant-man looked up and waved. Chuck waved back, although he knew the guy couldn't see him.
Beautiful goddamn day,
Claudie exclaimed. Chuck laughed. Their lives had another 40 seconds to run.
2. The woodchuck came bumbling along the shoulder of Route 119. Headed in the direction of Chester's Mill, although the town was still a mile and a half away, and even Jim Rennie's used cars was only a series of twinkling sun flashes arranged in rows at the place where the highway curved to the left. The Chuck planned, so far as a woodchuck can be said to plan anything, to head back into the woods long before he got that far. But for now, the shoulder was fine. He'd come farther from his burrow than he meant to, but the sun had been warm on his back, and the smells were crisp in his nose, forming rudimentary images, not quite pictures, in his brain. He stopped and rose on his back paws for an instant. His eyes weren't as good as they used to be, but good enough to make out a human up there, walking in his direction on the other shoulder. The Chuck decided he'd go a little farther anyway. Humans sometimes left behind good things to eat. He was an old fellow, and a fat fellow. He had raided many garbage cans in his time,
and knew the way to the Chester's Mill landfill as well as he knew the three tunnels of his own burrow. Always good things to eat at the landfill. He waddled a complacent old fellow's waddle, watching the human walking on the other side of the road. The man stopped. The Chuck realized he had been spotted. To his right and just ahead was a fallen birch. He would hide under there, wait for the man to go by, then investigate for any tasty... The Chuck got that far in his thoughts and another three waddling steps, although he had been cut in two. Then he fell apart on the edge of the road. Blood squirted and pumped. Guts tumbled into the dirt. His rear legs kicked rapidly twice, then stopped. His last thought before the darkness that comes to us all, Chucks and humans alike, what happened? 3. All the needles on the control panel dropped dead.
What the hell?
Claudie Sanders said. She turned to Chuck. Her eyes were wide, but there was no panic in them, only bewilderment. There was no time for panic. Chuck never saw the control panel. He saw the Seneca's nose crumple toward him. Then he saw both propellers disintegrate. There was no time to see more. No time for anything. The Seneca exploded over Route 119 and rained fire on the countryside. It also rained body parts. A smoking forearm, Claudette's, landed with a thump beside the neatly divided woodchuck. It was October 21st. Barbie. 1. Barbie started feeling better as soon as he passed Food City and left downtown behind. When he saw the sign reading, "You are leaving the village of Chester's Mill. Come back real soon," he felt better still. He was glad to be on his way, and not just because he had taken a pretty good beating in the mill. It was plain old moving on that had lightened him up. He'd been walking around under his own little gray cloud for at least 2 weeks before getting his shit handed to him in the parking lot of Dippers. "Basically, I'm just a rambling guy," he said, and laughed. "A rambling guy on his way to the big sky." And hell, why not? Montana. Or Wyoming. Fucking Rapid City, South Dakota. Any place but here. He heard an approaching engine, turned around, walking backward now, and stuck out his thumb. What he saw was a lovely combination. A dirty old Ford pick-em-up with a fresh young blonde behind the wheel. Ash blonde, his favorite blonde of all. Barbie offered his most engaging smile. The girl driving the pick-em-up responded with one of her own, and oh my lord, if she was a TikTok over 19, he'd eat his last paycheck from Sweetbriar Rose. Too young for a gentleman of 30 summers, no doubt, but perfectly street legal, as they'd said back in the days of his corn-fed Iowa youth. The truck slowed. He started toward it, and then it sped up again. She gave him one more brief look as she went past. The smile was still on her face, but it had turned regretful. "I had a brain cramp there for a minute," the smile said, "but now sanity has reasserted itself." And Barbie thought he recognized her a little, although it was impossible to say with certainty. Sunday mornings in Sweetbriar were always a madhouse. But he thought he'd seen her with an older man, probably her dad, both of them with their faces mostly buried in sections of the Sunday Times. If he could have spoken to her as she rolled past, Barbie would have said, "If you trusted me to cook your sausage and eggs, surely you can trust me for a few miles in the shotgun seat." But, of course, he didn't get the chance. So he simply raised his hand in a little no-offense-taken salute. The truck's taillights flickered, as if she were reconsidering. Then they went out, and the truck sped up. During the following days, as things in the mill started going from bad to worse, he would replay this little moment in the warm October sun again and again. It was that second reconsidering flicker of the taillights he thought of, as if she had recognized him, after all. "That's the cook from Sweetbriar Rose, I'm almost sure. Maybe I ought to..." But maybe was a gulf better men than him had fallen into. If she had reconsidered, everything in his life thereafter would have changed, because she must have made it out. He never saw the fresh-faced blonde or the dirty old Ford F-150 again.
She must have crossed over the Chester's Mill town line minutes, or even seconds, before the border slammed shut. If he'd been with her, he would have been out. And safe. Unless, of course, he'd think later, when sleep wouldn't come, the stop to pick me up was just long enough to be too long. In that case, I probably still wouldn't be here. And neither would she. Because the speed limit out that way on 119 is 50 miles an hour. And at 50 miles an hour, at this point, he would always think of the plane. 2. The plane flew over him just after he passed Jim Rennie's used cars, a place for which Barbie had no love. Not that he'd bought a lemon there. He hadn't owned a car in over a year, had sold the last one in Punta Gorda, Florida. It was just that Jim Rennie Jr. had been one of the fellows that night in Dipper's parking lot. A frat boy with something to prove. And what he could not prove alone, he would prove as part of a group. That was the way the Jim Juniors of the world did business, in Barbie's experience. But it was behind him now. Jim Rennie's, Jim Jr., Sweetbriar Rose, fried clams our specialty, always whole, never strips. Angie McCain, Andy Sanders, the whole deal, including dippers. Beatings administered in the parking lot, our specialty. All behind him. And ahead of him, why, the gates of America. Goodbye, small town Maine, hello, big sky. Or maybe, hell, he'd head down south again. No matter how beautiful this particular day, winter was lurking a page or two over on the calendar. The South might be good. He'd never been to Muscle Shoals, and he liked the sound of the name. That was goddamn poetry, Muscle Shoals was. And the idea so cheered him that when he heard the little plane approaching, he looked up and gave a big old exuberant wave. He hoped for a wing waggle in return, but didn't get one, although the plane was slow-poking at low altitude. Barbie's guess was sightseers. This was a day for them, with the trees in full flame. Or maybe some young kid on his learner's permit, too worried about screwing up to bother with groundlings like Dale Barbara. But he wished them well. Sightseers, or a kid still 6 weeks from his first solo cruise, Barbie wished them very well. It was a good day, and every step away from Chester's Mill made it better. Too many assholes in the mill, and besides, travel was good for the soul. Maybe moving on in October should be a law, he thought. New national motto, everybody leaves in October. You get your packing permit in August, give your required week's notice in mid-September, then... He stopped. Not too far ahead of him on the other side of the blacktop highway was a woodchuck. A damned fat one. Sleek and sassy, too. Instead of scurrying off into the high grass, it was coming on ahead. There was a fallen birch sticking its top half out onto the shoulder of the road, and Barbie was betting the woodchuck would scurry under there and wait for the big bad two legs to go by. If not, they would pass each other like the rambling guys they were. The one on four legs headed north, the one on two headed south. Barbie hoped that would happen. It would be cool. These thoughts went through Barbie's mind in seconds. The shadow of the airplane was still between him and the chuck, a black cross racing along the highway. Then two things happened, almost simultaneously. The first was the woodchuck. It was whole, then it was in two pieces. Both were twitching and bleeding. Barbie stopped, mouth hanging open on the suddenly lax hinge of his lower jaw. It was as if an invisible guillotine blade had dropped. And that was when, directly above the severed woodchuck, the little airplane exploded. 3. Barbie looked up. Falling from the sky was a squashed, bizarro world version of the pretty little airplane that had passed over him seconds before. Twisting orange-red petals of fire hung above it in the air. A flower that was still opening, an American disaster rose. Smoke billowed from the plummeting plane. Something clanged to the road and sprayed up clods of asphalt before spinning drunkenly into the high grass to the left. A propeller. If that had bounced my way. Barbie had a brief image of being cut in two, like the unfortunate woodchuck, and turned to run. Something thudded down in front of him, and he screamed. But it wasn't the other propeller. It was a man's leg dressed in denim. He could see no blood, but the side seam had been blown wide open, revealing white flesh and wiry black hair. there was no foot attached. Barbie ran in what felt like slow motion. He saw one of his own feet, clad in an old scuffed work boot, stride out and clop down. Then it disappeared behind him as his other foot strode out, all slow, slow, like watching the baseball replay of a guy trying to steal second. There was a tremendous hollow clang from behind him, followed by the boom of a secondary explosion, followed by a blast of heat that struck him from heels to nape. It shoved him on his way like a warm hand. Then all thoughts blew away, and there was nothing but the body's brute need to survive. Dale Barbara ran for his life. 4. 100 yards or so down the road, the big warm hand became a ghost hand. Although the smell of burning gas, plus a sweeter stench that had to be a mixture of melting plastic and roasting flesh, was strong, carried to him on a light breeze. Barbie ran another 60 yards, then stopped and turned around. He was panting. He didn't think it was the running. He didn't smoke, and he was in good shape. Well, fair. His ribs on the right side still hurt from the beating in Dipper's parking lot. He thought it was terror and dismay. He could have been killed by falling pieces of airplane, not just the runaway propeller, or burned to death. It was only blind luck that he hadn't been. Then he saw something that made his rapid breathing stop in mid-gasp. He straightened up, looking back at the site of the accident. The road was littered with debris. It really was a wonder that he hadn't been struck and at least wounded. A twisted wing lay on the right. The other wing was poking out of the uncut timothy grass on the left, not far from where the runaway propeller had come to rest. In addition to the blue jeans-clad leg, he could see a severed hand and arm. The hand seemed to be pointing at a head, as if to say, "That's mine." A woman's head, judging from the hair. The power lines running beside the highway had been severed. They lay crackling and twisting on the shoulder. Beyond the head and arm was the twisted tube of the airplane's fuselage. Barbie could read NJ3. If there was more, it was torn away. But none of this was what had caught his eye and stopped his breath. The disaster rose was gone now, but there was still fire in the sky. Burning fuel, certainly, but it was running down the air in a thin sheet. Beyond it, and through it, Barbie could see the main countryside, still peaceful, not yet reacting, but in motion nevertheless, shimmering like the air over an incinerator or a burning barrel. It was as if someone had splashed gasoline over a pane of glass and then set it alight. Almost hypnotized, that was what it felt like anyway, Barbie started walking back toward the scene of the crash. 5. His first impulse was to cover the body parts, but there were too many. Now he could see another leg, this one in green slacks, and a female torso caught in a clump of juniper. He could pull off his shirt and drape it over the woman's head, but after that, well, there were 2 extra shirts in his backpack. Here came a car from the direction of Mauton, the next town to the south, one of the smaller SUVs, and moving fast. Someone had either heard the crash or seen the flash. Help. Thank God for help. Straddling the white line and standing well clear of the fire that was still running down from the sky and that weird water on a window paneway, Barbie waved his arms over his head, crossing them in big X's. The driver honked once in acknowledgement, then slammed on his brakes, laying 40 feet of rubber. He was out almost before his little green Toyota had stopped, a big, rangy fellow with long gray hair cascading out from under a sea dog's baseball cap. He ran toward the side of the road, meaning to skirt the main firefall. "What happened?" he cried. "What in the blue fu-" Then he struck something. Hard. There was nothing there. But Barbie saw the guy's nose snap to the side as it broke. The man rebounded from the nothing, bleeding from the mouth, nose, and forehead. He fell on his back, then struggled to a sitting position. He stared at Barbie with dazed, wondering eyes as blood from his nose and mouth cascaded down the front of his work shirt. And Barbie stared back. Junior and Angie. 1. The two boys fishing near the Peace Bridge didn't look up when the plane flew overhead, but Junior Rennie did. He was a block farther down, on Prestile Street, and he recognized the sound. It was Chuck Thompson's Seneca 5. He looked up, saw the plane, then dropped his head fast when the bright sunlight shining through the trees sent a bolt of agony in through his eyes. Another headache. He'd been having a lot of them lately. Sometimes the medication killed them. Sometimes, especially in the last 3 or 4 months, it didn't. Migraines, Dr. Haskell said. All Junior knew was that they hurt like the end of the world, and bright light made them worse, especially when they were hatching. Sometimes he thought of the ants he and Frank the Lesseps had burned up when they were just kids. He used a magnifying glass and focused the sun on them as they crawled in and out of their hill. The result was fricasseed formicants. Only these days, when one of his headaches was hatching, his brain was the anthill and his eyes turned into twin magnifying glasses. He was 21. Did he have this to look forward to until he was 45 or so, when Dr. Haskell said they might let up? Maybe. But this morning a headache wasn't going to stop him. The sight of Henry McCain's Forerunner, or LaDonna McCain's Prius in the driveway, might have. In that case, he might have turned around, gone back to his own house, taken another Imitrex, and lain down in his bedroom with the shades drawn and a cool washcloth on his forehead, possibly feeling the pain start to diminish as the headache derailed, but probably not. Once those black spiders really got a foothold. He looked up again, this time squinting his eyes against the hateful light, but the Seneca was gone, and even the buzz of its engine, also aggravating, all sounds were aggravating when he was getting one of these bitch kitties, was fading. Chuck Thompson was some fly boy or fly girl wannabe. And although Junior had nothing against Chuck, hardly knew him, he wished with sudden childish ferocity that Chuck's pupil would fuck up big time and crash the plane. Preferably in the middle of his father's car dealership. Another sickish throb of pain twisted through his head. But he went up the steps to the McCain's door anyway. This had to be done. This was over-fucking-due. Angie needed a lesson. But just a little one, don't let yourself get out of control. As if summoned, his mother's voice replied, her maddeningly complacent voice. Junior was always a bad-tempered boy, but he keeps it under much better control now, don't you, Junior? Well, gee, he had, anyway. Football had helped, but now there was no football. Now there wasn't even college. Instead, there were the headaches, and they made him feel like one mean motherfucker. Don't let yourself get out of control. No, but he would talk to her, headache or no headache. And as the old saying was, he just might have to talk to her by hand. Who knew? Making Angie feel worse might make him feel better. Junior rang the bell. 2. Angie McCain was just out of the shower. She slipped on a robe, belted it, then wrapped a towel around her wet hair. "Coming," she called, as she not quite trotted down the stairs to the first floor. There was a little smile on her face. It was Frankie. She was quite sure it must be Frankie. Things were finally coming right side up. The bastardly short order cook, good-looking but still a bastard, had either left town or was leaving, and her parents were out. Combine the two, and you got a sign from God that things were coming right side up. She and Frankie could put all the crap in the rear view and get back together. She knew exactly how to handle it. Open the door, and then open her robe. Right there in the Saturday morning daylight where anybody passing might see her. She'd make sure it was Frankie first, of course. She had no intention of flashing fat old Mr. Wicker if he'd rung the bell with a package or a registered mail. But it was at least half an hour too early for the mail. No, it was Frankie, she was sure. She opened the door, the little smile widening to a welcoming grin, perhaps not fortunate since her teeth were rather crammed together and the size of jumbo chiclets. One hand was on the tie of her robe, but she didn't pull it. because it wasn't Frankie, it was Junior, and he looked so angry. She had seen his black look before, many times, in fact, but never this black since 8th grade, when Junior broke the Dupree kid's arm. The little fag had dared to swish his bubble butt onto the town common basketball court and asked to play. And she supposed Junior must have had the same thunderstorm on his face that night in Dipper's parking lot. But of course she hadn't been there. She had only heard about it. Everybody in the mill had heard about it. She'd been called in to talk to Chief Perkins. That damn Barbie had been there. And eventually, that had gotten out too.
Junior? Junior, what?
Then he slapped her, and thinking pretty much ceased. 3. He didn't get much into that first one, because he was still in the doorway and there wasn't much room to swing. He could only draw his arm back to half-cock. He might not have hit her at all, at least not to start with. Had she not been flashing a grin, God, those teeth. They'd given him the creeps even in grammar school. And if she hadn't called him Junior. Of course, everyone in town called him Junior. He thought of himself as Junior, but he hadn't realized how much he hated it, how much he hoped to die in a maggot pie hated it, until he heard it come bolting out from between the spooky tombstone teeth of the bitch who had caused him so much trouble. The sound of it went through his head like the sun glare when he'd looked up to see the plane. But as slaps from half-cock go, this one wasn't bad. She went stumbling backward against the newel post of the stairway, and the towel flew off her hair. Wet brown snaggles hung around her cheeks, making her look like Medusa. The smile had been replaced by a look of stunned surprise, and Junior saw a trickle of blood running from the corner of her mouth. That was good. That was fine. The bitch deserved to bleed for what she had done. So much trouble. Not just for him, but for Frankie and Mel and Carter, too. His mother's voice in his head, "Don't let yourself get out of control, honey." She was dead, and still wouldn't stop giving advice. Teach her a lesson, but make it a little one. And he really might have managed to do that, but then her robe came open and she was naked underneath it. He could see the dark patch of hair over her breeding farm, her goddamn itchy breeding farm that was all the fucking trouble. When you got right down to it, those farms were all the fucking trouble in the world. And his head was throbbing, thudding, whamming, smashing, splitting. It felt like it was going to go thermonuclear at any moment. A perfect little mushroom cloud would shoot out of each ear just before everything exploded above the neck, and Junior Rennie, who didn't know he had a brain tumor, wheezy old Dr. Haskell had never even considered the possibility, not in an otherwise healthy young man hardly out of his teens, went crazy. It wasn't a lucky morning for Claudette Sanders or Chuck Thompson. In point of fact, it wasn't a lucky morning for anyone in Chester's Mill. But few were as unlucky as the ex-girlfriend of Frank DeLesseps. 4. She did have two more semi-coherent thoughts as she leaned against the newel post and looked at his bulging eyes and the way he was biting his tongue. Biting it so hard his teeth sunk into it. "He's crazy. I have to call the police before he really hurts me." She turned to run down the front hall to the kitchen, where she would pull the handset off the wall phone, punch 911, and then just start screaming. She got 2 steps, then stumbled on the towel she'd wrapped around her hair. She regained her balance quickly. She had been a cheerleader in high school, and those skills hadn't left her. But it was still too late. Her head snapped back, and her feet flew out in front of her. He had grabbed her by her hair. He yanked her against his body. He was baking, as if with a high fever. She could feel his heartbeat, quick, quick, running away with itself. "You lying bitch," he screamed directly into her ear. It sent a spike of pain deep into her head. She screamed herself, but the sound seemed faint and inconsequential compared to his. Then his arms were wrapped around her waist, and she was being propelled down the hall at a manic speed, nothing but her toes touching the carpet. Something went through her mind about being the hood ornament on a runaway car, and then they were in the kitchen, which was filled with brilliant sunshine. Junior screamed again, this time not with rage, but pain. 5. The light was killing him. It was frying his howling brains, but he didn't let it stop him. Too late for that now. He ran her straight into the formica-topped kitchen table without slowing. It struck her in the stomach, then slid and slammed into the wall. The sugar bowl and the salt and pepper went flying. Her breath escaped her in a big woofing sound. Holding her around the waist with one hand and by the wet snaggles of her hair with the other, Junior whirled her and threw her against the cold spot. She struck it with a bang that knocked off most of the fridge magnets. Her face was dazed and paper pale. Now she was bleeding from her nose as well as her lower lip. The blood was brilliant against her white skin. He saw her eyes shift toward the butcher block filled with knives on the counter, and when she tried to rise, he brought his knee into the center of her face, hard. There was a muffled crunching sound, as if someone had dropped a big piece of china, a platter, maybe, in another room. "It's what I should have done to Dale Barbara," he thought, and stepped back with the heels of his palms pressed against his throbbing temples. Tears from his watering eyes spilled down his cheeks. He had bitten his tongue badly. Blood was streaming down his chin and pattering on the floor, but Junior wasn't aware of it. The pain in his head was too intense. Angie lay face down among the fridge magnets. The largest said, "What goes in your mouth today shows up on your ass tomorrow." He thought she was out, but all at once she began to shiver all over. Her fingers trembled as if she were preparing to play something complex on the piano. "Only instrument this bitch ever played is the skin flute," he thought. Then her legs began to crash up and down, and her arms followed suit. Now Angie looked like she was trying to swim away from him. She was having a goddamn seizure. "Stop it," he shouted. Then, as she voided herself, "Stop it! Stop doing that, you bitch!" He dropped on his knees, one on each side of her head, which was now bobbing up and down. Her forehead repeatedly smacked the tile, like one of those camel jockeys saluting Allah. "Stop it! Fucking stop it!" She began to make a growling noise. It was surprisingly loud. Christ, what if someone heard her? What if he got caught here? This wouldn't be like explaining to his father why he'd left school, a thing Junior had not as yet been able to bring himself to do. This time, it would be worse than having his monthly allowance cut by 75% because of that goddamn fight with the cook, the fight this useless bitch had instigated. This time, Big Jim Rennie wouldn't be able to talk Chief Perkins and the local fuzznuts around. This could be... A picture of Shawshank State Prison's brooding green walls suddenly popped into his mind. He couldn't go there. He had his whole life ahead of him. But he would. Even if he shut her up now, he would. Because she'd talk later. And her face, which looked a lot worse than Barbie's had after the fight in the parking lot, would talk for her. Unless he shut her up completely. Junior seized her by the hair and helped her wham her head against the tiles. He was hoping it would knock her out so he could finish doing... well, whatever. But the seizure only intensified. She began beating her feet against the cold spot, and the rest of the magnets came down in a shower. He let go of her hair and seized her by the throat. Said, "I'm sorry, Ange, it wasn't supposed to happen like this." But he wasn't sorry. He was only scared and in pain, and convinced that her struggles in this horribly bright kitchen would never end. His fingers were already getting tired. Who knew it was so hard to choke a person? Somewhere far off to the south, there was a boom, as if someone had fired a very large gun. Junior paid no attention. What Junior did was redouble his grip, and at last Angie's struggles began to weaken. Somewhere, much closer by, in the house, on this floor, a low chiming began. He looked up, eyes wide, at first sure it was the doorbell. Someone had heard the ruckus, and the cops were here. His head was exploding. It felt like he had sprained all his fingers, and it had all been for nothing. A terrible picture flitted through his mind. Junior Rennie being escorted into the Castle County Courthouse for arraignment with some cop's sport coat over his head. Then he recognized the sound. It was the same chiming his own computer made when the electricity went out, and it had to switch over to battery power. Bing. 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 Room service. Send me up a room, he thought, and went on choking. She was still now, but he kept at it for another minute with his head turned to one side, trying to avoid the smell of her shit. How like her to leave such a nasty going-away present. How like them all. Women. Women in their breeding farms. Nothing but anthills covered with hair. And they said men were the problem. 6. He was standing over her bloody, beshitted, and undoubtedly dead body, wondering what to do next, when there was another distant boom from the south. Not a gun. Much too big. An explosion. Maybe Chuck Thompson's fancy little airplane had crashed after all. It wasn't impossible. On a day when you set out just to shout at someone, read them the riot act a little, no more than that, and she ended up making you kill her, anything was possible. A police siren started yowling. Junior was sure it was for him. Someone had looked in the window and seen him choking her. It galvanized him into action. He started down the hall to the front door, got as far as the towel he'd knocked off her hair with that first slap, then stopped. They'd come that way. That was just the way they'd come. Pull up out front, those bright new LED flashers sending arrows of pain into the squalling meat of his poor brain. He turned around and ran back to the kitchen. He looked down before stepping over Angie's body. He couldn't help it. In first grade, he and Frank had sometimes pulled her braids, and she would stick her tongue out at them and cross her eyes. Now her eyes bulged from their sockets like ancient marbles, and her mouth was full of blood. Did I do that? Did I really? Yes, he had. And even that single fleeting look was enough to explain why. Her fucking teeth. Those humongous choppers. A second siren joined the first, then a third, but they were going away. Thank Christ, they were going away. They were heading south down Main Street, toward those booming sounds. Nevertheless, Junior did not slow down. He skulked across the McCains' backyard, unaware that he would have screamed guilt about something to anyone who happened to be watching. No one was. Beyond LaDonna's tomato plants was a high board fence and a gate. There was a padlock, but it was hanging open on the hasp. In his years of growing up and sometimes hanging out here, Junior had never seen it closed. He opened the gate. Beyond were scrub woods, and a path leading down to the muted babble of Prestille Stream. Once, when he was 13, Junior had spied Frank and Angie standing on that path and kissing, her arms around his neck, his hand cupping her breast, and understood that childhood was almost over. He leaned down and vomited into the running water. The sun dapples on the water were malicious, awful. Then his vision cleared enough so he could see the Peace Bridge to his right. The Fisher boys were gone, but as he looked, a pair of police cars raced down Town Common Hill. The town whistle went off. The town hall generator had kicked on just as it was supposed to during a power failure, allowing the whistle to broadcast its high decibel disaster message. Junior moaned and covered his ears. The Peace Bridge was really just a covered pedestrian walkway, now ramshackle and sagging. Its actual name was the Alvin Chester Pass-Through, but it had become the Peace Bridge in 1969, when some kids, at the time there had been rumors in town about which ones, had painted a big blue peace sign on the side. It was still there, although now faded to a ghost. For the last 10 years, Peace Bridge had been condemned. Police do not cross tape X'd both ends, but of course it was still used. 2 or 3 nights a week, members of Chief Perkins' Fuzznuts Brigade would shine their lights in there, always at one end or the other, never both. They didn't want to bust the kids who were drinking and necking, just scare them away. Every year, at town meeting, someone would move that Peace Bridge be demolished, and someone else would move that it be renovated, and both motions would be tabled. The town had its own secret will, it seemed, and that secret will wanted the Peace Bridge to stay just as it was. Today, Junior Rennie was glad of that. He shambled along the Prestille's northern bank until he was beneath the bridge. The police sirens now fading, the town whistle yelling as loud as ever, and climbed up to Strout Lane. He looked both ways, then trotted past the sign reading Dead End, Bridge Closed. He ducked under the crisscross of yellow tape into the shadows. The sun shone through the holy roof, dropping dimes of light on the worn wooden boards underfoot. But after the blaze of that kitchen from hell, it was blessedly dark. Pigeons sweet-talked in the roof beams. Beer cans and Alan's coffee-flavored brandy bottles were scattered along the wooden sides. I will never get away with this. I don't know if I left any of me under her nails, can't remember if she got me or not, but my blood's there. And my fingerprints. I only have two choices, really. Run, or turn myself in. No. There was a third. He could kill himself. He had to get home. Had to draw all the curtains in his room and turn it into a cave. Take another Imitrex, lie down, maybe sleep a little. Then he might be able to think. And if they came for him while he was asleep, why, that would save him the problem of choosing between door number one, door number two, or door number three. Junior crossed the town common. When someone, some old guy he only vaguely recognized, grabbed his arm and said, "What happened, Junior? What's going on?" Junior only shook his head, brushed the old man's hand away, and kept going. Behind him, the town whistle whooped like the end of the world. Highways and Byways. 1. There was a weekly newspaper in Chester's Mill called The Democrat, which was misinformation, since ownership and management, both hats worn by the formidable Julia Shumway, was Republican to the core. The masthead looked like this. The Chester's Mill Democrat, established 1890, serving the little town that looks like a boot. But the motto was misinformation, too. Chester's Mill didn't look like a boot. It looked like a kid's athletic sock so filthy it was able to stand up on its own. Although touched by the much larger and more prosperous Castle Rock to the southwest, the heel of the sock, the mill was actually surrounded by four towns larger in area but smaller in population. Motton to the south and southeast, Harlow to the east and northeast, the unincorporated TR-90 to the north, and Tarker's Mills to the west. Chester's and Tarker's were sometimes known as the Twin Mills, and between them, in the days when central and western Maine textile mills were running full bore, had turned Presteel Stream into a polluted and fishless sump that changed color almost daily and according to location. In those days, you could start out by canoe and Tarker's running on green water and be on bright yellow by the time you crossed out of Chester's Mill and into Motton. Plus, if your canoe was made of wood, the paint might be gone below the waterline. But the last of those profitable pollution factories had closed in 1979. The weird colors had left the Presteel, and the fish had returned, although whether or not they were fit for human consumption remained a matter of debate. The Democrat voted aye. The town's population was seasonal. Between Memorial Day and Labor Day, it was close to 15,000. The rest of the year, it was just a tad over or under two, depending on the balance of births and deaths at Catherine Russell, which was considered to be the best hospital north of Lewiston. If you asked the summer people how many roads led in and out of the mill, most would say there were two, Route 117, which led to Norway, South Paris, and Route 119, which went through downtown Castle Rock on its way to Lewiston. Residents of 10 years or so could have named at least eight more, all two-lane blacktop, from the Black Ridge and deep-cut roads that went into Harlow to the Pretty Valley Road, yes, just as pretty as its name, that wound north into TR-90. Residents of 30 years or more, if given time to mull it over, perhaps in the back room of Brownie's store where there was still a wood stove, could have named another dozen, with names both sacred, God Creek Road, and profane, Little Bitch Road, noted on local survey maps with nothing but a number. The oldest resident of Chester's Mill on what came to be known as Dome Day was Clayton Brassey. He was also the oldest resident of Castle County and thus holder of the Boston Post cane. Unfortunately, he no longer knew what a Boston Post cane was, or even precisely who he was. He sometimes mistook his great-great-granddaughter, Nell, for his wife, who was 40 years dead, and the Democrat had stopped doing its yearly oldest resident interview with him 3 years previous. On the last occasion, when asked for the secret of his longevity, Clayton had responded, "Where's my Christing dinner?" Senility had begun to creep up shortly after his 100th birthday. On this October 21st, he was 105. He had once been a fine Finnish carpenter specializing in dressers, banisters, and moldings. His specialties in these latter days included eating jello pudding without getting it up his nose, and occasionally making it to the toilet before releasing half a dozen blood-streaked pebbles into the commode. But in his prime, around the age of 85, say, he could have named almost all the roads leading in and out of Chester's Mill, and the total would have been 34. Most were dirt, many were forgotten, and almost all of the forgotten ones wound through deep tangles of second-growth forest owned by Diamond Match, Continental Paper Company, and American Timber. And shortly before noon on Dome Day, every one of them snapped closed. 2. On most of these roads, there was nothing so spectacular as the explosion of the Seneca 5 and the ensuing pulp truck disaster. But there was trouble. Of course there was. If the equivalent of an invisible stone wall suddenly goes up around an entire town, there is bound to be trouble. At the same exact moment the woodchuck fell in two pieces, a scarecrow did the same in Eddie Chalmers's pumpkin field, not far from Pretty Valley Road. The scarecrow stood directly on the town line dividing the mill from TR-90. Its divided stance had always amused Eddie, who called his bird frightener the scarecrow without a country. Mr. Swack, for short. Half of Mr. Swack fell in the mill. The other half fell on the TR, as the locals would have put it. Seconds later, a flight of crows bound for Eddie's pumpkins. The crows had never been afraid of Mr. Swack. Struck something where nothing had ever been before. Most broke their necks and fell in black clumps on Pretty Valley Road and the fields on both sides. Birds everywhere, on both sides of the dome, crashed and fell dead. Their bodies would be one of the ways the new barrier was eventually delineated. On God Creek Road, Bob Rue had been digging potatoes. He came in for lunch, more commonly known as dinner in those parts, sitting astride his old Deere tractor and listening to his brand new iPod, a gift from his wife on what would prove to be his final birthday. His house was only half a mile from the field he'd been digging, but unfortunately for him, the field was in Motton, and the house was in Chester's Mill. He struck the barrier at 15 miles an hour while listening to James Blunt sing, "You're Beautiful." He had the loosest of grips on the tractor's steering wheel because he could see the road all the way to his house, and there was nothing on it. So when his tractor came to a smash halt, the potato digger rising up behind and then crashing back down, Bob was flung forward over the engine block and directly into the dome. His iPod exploded in the wide front pocket of his bib overalls, but he never felt it. He broke his neck and fractured his skull on the nothing he collided with and died in the dirt shortly thereafter by one tall wheel of his tractor, which was still idling. Nothing, you know, runs like a deer. 3. At no point did the Motton Road actually run through Motton. It ran just inside the Chester's Mill town line. Here were new residential homes, in an area that had been called East Chester since 1975 or so. The owners were 30 and 40-somethings who commuted to Lewiston, Auburn, where they worked for good wages, mostly in white-collar jobs. All of these homes were in the mill, but many of their backyards were in Motton. This was the case with Jack and Myra Evans' home at 379 Motton Road. Myra had a vegetable garden behind their house, and although most of the goodies had been harvested, there were still a few fat Blue Hubbard squashes beyond the remaining and badly rotted pumpkins. She was reaching for one of these when the dome came down, and although her knees were in Chester's Mill, she happened to be reaching for a Blue Hubbard that was growing a foot or so across the Motton line. She didn't cry out because there was no pain. Not at first. It was too quick and sharp and clean for that. Jack Evans was in the kitchen, whipping eggs for a noontime frittata. LCD sound system was playing, North American scum. And Jack was singing along when a small voice spoke his name from behind him. He didn't at first recognize the voice as belonging to his wife of 14 years. It sounded like the voice of a child. But when he turned, he saw it was indeed Myra. She was standing inside the doorway, holding her right arm across her middle. She had tracked mud onto the floor, which was very unlike her. Usually she took her garden shoes off on the stoop. Her left hand, clad in a filthy gardening glove, was cradling her right hand, and red stuff was running through the muddy fingers. At first he thought, cranberry juice, but only for a second. It was blood. Jack dropped the bowl he'd been holding. It shattered on the floor. Myra said his name again in that same tiny, trembling child voice.
What happened, Myra? What happened to you?
I had an accident, she said, and showed him her right hand.
Only there was no muddy right gardening glove to match the left one, and no right hand. Only a spouting stump. She gave him a weak smile and said,
Whoops.
Her eyes rolled up to whites. The crotch of her gardening jeans darkened as her urine let go. Then her knees also let go, and she went down. The blood gushing from her raw wrist, an anatomy lesson cutaway, mixed with the eggy batter splattered across the floor. When Jack dropped to his knees beside her, a shard from the bowl jabbed deep into his knee. He hardly noticed, although he would limp on that leg for the rest of his life. He seized her arm and squeezed. The terrible blood gush from her wrist slowed, but didn't stop. He tore his belt free of its loops and noosed it around her lower forearm. That did the job, but he couldn't notch the belt tight. The loop was far beyond the buckle.
Christ! He told the empty kitchen. Christ!
It was darker than it had been, he realized. The power had gone out. He could hear the computer in the study chiming its distress call. LCD sound system was okay because the little boombox on the counter was battery-powered. Not that Jack cared any longer. He'd lost his taste for techno.
So much blood. So much.
Questions about how she'd lost her hand left his mind. He had more immediate concerns. He couldn't let go of the belt tourniquet to get to the phone. She'd start to bleed again, and she might already be close to bleeding out. She would have to go with him. He tried pulling her by her shirt, but first it yanked out of her pants, and then the collar started to choke her. He heard her breathing turn harsh. So he wrapped a hand in her long brown hair and hauled her to the phone, caveman style. It was a cell, and it worked. He dialed 911, and 911 was busy.
Can't be,
he shouted to the empty kitchen, where the lights were now out, although from the boombox the band played on.
911 cannot be fucking busy.
He punched redial.
Busy.
He sat in the kitchen with his back propped up against the counter, holding the tourniquet as tightly as he could, staring at the blood and the batter on the floor, periodically hitting redial on the phone, always getting the same stupid duh, duh, duh. Something blew up not too far distant, but he barely heard it over the music, which was really cranked. And he never heard the Seneca explosion at all. He wanted to turn the music off, but in order to reach the boombox, he would have to lift Myra, lift her or let go of the belt for 2 or 3 seconds. He didn't want to do either one. So he sat there, and North American scum gave way to Someone Great, and Someone Great gave way to All My Friends. And after a few more songs, finally the CD, which was called Sound of Silver, ended. When it did, when there was silence except for police sirens in the distance and the endlessly chiming computer closer by, Jack realized that his wife was no longer breathing. But I was going to make lunch, he thought. A nice lunch. One you wouldn't be ashamed of inviting Martha Stewart to. Sitting against the counter, still holding the belt, opening his fingers again would prove exquisitely painful. The lower right leg of his own pants darkening with blood from his lacerated knee. Jack Evans cradled his wife's head against his chest and began to weep. 4. Not too far away, on an abandoned woods road not even old Clay Brassy would have remembered, a deer was foraging tender shoots at the edge of Presteel Marsh. Her neck happened to be stretched across the Motton town line, and when the dome dropped, her head tumbled off. It was severed so neatly that the deed might have been done with a guillotine blade. 5. We have toured the sock shape that is Chester's Mill and arrived back at Route 119. And, thanks to the magic of narration, not an instant has passed since the 60-ish fellow from the Toyota slammed face-first into something invisible, but very hard, and broke his nose. He's sitting up and staring at Dale Barbara in utter bewilderment. A seagull, probably on its daily commute from the tasty buffet at the Mottentown dump to the only slightly less tasty one at the Chester's Mill landfill, drops like a stone and thumps down not 3 feet from the 60-ish fellow's sea dog's baseball cap, which he picks up, brushes off, and puts back on. Both men look up at where the bird came from and see one more incomprehensible thing in a day that will turn out to be full of them. 6. Barbie's first thought was that he was looking at an afterimage from the exploding plane. The way you sometimes see a big blue floating dot after someone triggers a flash camera close to your face. Only this wasn't a dot, it wasn't blue, and instead of floating along when he looked in a different direction, in this case at his new acquaintance, the smudge hanging in the air stayed exactly where it was. Sea Dogs was looking up and rubbing his eyes. He seemed to have forgotten about his broken nose, swelling lips, and bleeding forehead. He got to his feet, almost losing his balance because he was craning his neck so severely. "What's that?" he said. "What the hell is that, mister?" A big black smear, candle flame-shaped, if you really used your imagination, discolored the blue sky. "Is it a cloud?" Sea Dogs asked. His doubtful tone suggested he already knew it wasn't. Barbie said, "I think..." He really didn't want to hear himself say this. "I think it's where the plane hit." "Say what?" Sea Dogs asked, but before Barbie could reply, a good-sized grackle swooped 50 feet overhead. It struck nothing, nothing they could see at any rate, and dropped not far from the gull. Sea Dogs said, "Did you see that?" Barbie nodded, then pointed to the patch of burning hay to his left. It, and the two or three patches on the right side of the road, were sending up thick columns of black smoke to join the smoke rising from the pieces of the dismembered Seneca. But the fire wasn't going far. There had been heavy rain the day before, and the hay was still damp. Lucky thing, or there would have been grass fires racing away in both directions. "Do you see that?" Barbie asked Sea Dogs. "I'll be dipped in shit," Sea Dogs said after taking a good long look. The fire had burned a patch of ground about 60 feet square, moving forward until it was almost opposite the place where Barbie and Sea Dogs were facing one another. And there it spread, west to the edge of the highway, east into some small dairy farmer's 4 acres of grazeland. Not raggedly, not the way grass fires normally advance, with the fire a bit ahead in one place and falling a little behind somewhere else, but as if on a straight edge. Another gull came flying toward them, this one bound for Motton rather than the mill. "Look out," Sea Dog said. "Ware that bird." "Maybe it'll be okay," Barbie said, looking up and shading his eyes. "Maybe whatever it is only stops them if they're coming from the south." "Judging by yonder busted plane, I doubt that," Sea Dog said. He spoke in the musing tones of a man who is deeply perplexed. The outbound gull struck the barrier and fell directly into the largest chunk of the burning plane. "Stops them both ways," Sea Dog said. He spoke in the tone of a man who has gotten confirmation of a strongly held but previously unproved conviction. "It's some kind of force field, like in a Star Trek movie."
"Trek," Barbie said.
"Huh?" "Oh, shit," Barbie said. He was looking over Sea Dog's shoulder. "Huh?" Sea Dogs looked over his own shoulder. "Blue fuck." A pulp truck was coming. A big one, loaded well past the legal weight limit with huge logs. It was also rolling well above the legal limit. Barbie tried to calculate what the stopping speed on such a behemoth might be and couldn't even guess. Sea Dogs sprinted for his Toyota, which he'd left parked askew on the highway's broken white line. The guy behind the wheel of the pulper, maybe high on pills, maybe smoked up on meth, maybe just young, in a big hurry and feeling immortal, saw him and laid on his horn. He wasn't slowing.
Fuck me sideways, Sea Dogs cried as he threw himself behind the wheel. He keyed the engine and backed the Toyota out of the road with the driver's door flapping. The little SUV thumped into the ditch with its square nose canted up to the sky.